Good afternoon, Shane, and most of our listeners will readily associate your name with the band Goanna, with whom you first rose to prominence back in about 1982 with that great song called Solid Rock. So tell me, what influenced you to compose that ironic song in the first place?
Well, hi, Nigel and listeners. Growing up in southwest Victoria, which is where I live now, I came back here after having a good look around, Aboriginal people were a fact of life for us growing up, so that invites lots of questions. And of course, then from the particular to the general, as I got travelling further and further afield, I realised I hitchhiked up the east coast of Australia when I was about 19 years old, you know, back in the Jurassic era. And I realised I encountered a lot of Aboriginal people in my journeys and started to hear the stories of dispossession, of the early colonial brutality, the theft, the dispossession, the loss of culture, the loss of language, all those things, the brutality of the colonial imposition. It just kept asking big questions about, well, who is Australian? And so all of that fed into my work. I wrote a few early songs, like a song called Corroboree, and influenced by Cath Walker's Ujuru Nurnuckles poetry. And then my politicisation through my uni days as well, at Monash and then at Deakin Uni, I was a student president. So it became kind of an important issue for me as I started to receive a lot of political information that came out of a place, particularly a place called the Black Resource Centre in Brisbane.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to meet those people years later, Cheryl Buchanan and people like that, who were at the forefront of the kind of that land rights movement in the 70s and stuff. Then when I went to Uluru, for the first time in 1981, I was powerfully moved to experience Inmar out there, which was, I just happened to be there at a time that coincided when the Anangu mob from Armada, south of Uluru, were coming back to establish a little canvas tent and sell artifacts, but they're also coming back to reclaim their country, their land. And like, there was a land rights legislation for South Australia in about 1980, but it didn't include the Northern Territory. And, of course, you know, the old Pitjantjatjara borders are not the same as our Whitefella borders. Mm. And so Uluru and those places north of the South Australian border were excluded. So they wanted to try and get some kind of land rights claim or native title right. There wasn't native title at that point. That wasn't until 10 years later. So I just happened to coincide, and I witnessed Inmar, which is like song and dance, traditional song and dance that night. It was a very powerful experience. I was out there for about 10 days and got to meet the people. I camped out that night. And it really awoke for me the deep feelings of, well, I'm in someone else's country. And I can't speak the language. I don't know the stories, the songs, the dances. And it began really for me a journey of discovery, I guess, Nigel, into the real heart and soul of this country. And Solid Rock was the song that emerged out of that experience. It's a bit of a point the finger song, but the first two verses are very gentle. They talk about country, and out here nothing changes. But when I went back to Alice Springs after that experience, that deeply cultural experience, I saw the racism, the neglect, the abuse, the drunkenness, the consequences of the colonial imposition. I couldn't turn away from that. It felt all important. And really, that song then went on to become so commercially successful, ironically, that it really shaped the rest of my life's work.
I understand the rest of the band didn't think it had any commercial appeal at all. You're with the sole voice who thought it had potential, and of course you proved to be right.
Well, there were varying opinions in the band. Graham Davidge, who came into the band, who was, you know, one of our lead guitarists, he had spent a lot of time working at CASM in South Australia, the Centre for Aboriginal Studies and Music, and that was an incredibly important place. Out of there came No Fixed Address, you know, Bart Willoughby, Joe Geyer, Cuckles, which was Jimmy Chai and Stephen Pigram and those people in Broome. It was a very influential place. I would say it was the tip of the spear of modern Aboriginal music in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of different opinions with the band. Some people thought it was too political. I know the record company at the time felt it was The marketing people went too political. They wanted us to release something else. But I felt really strongly that should be our first statement as Goanna in a commercial sense like that. I thought we might get a little bit of airplay, get to travel to Sydney, which we hadn't done. Little did I know what was coming, and it just took off and went to the top of the charts around the country. And while a lot of non-Indigenous people might not have got the depth of the meaning of the song, every Aboriginal person in the country knew the first time they heard it what was going on. And so that threw me headfirst into Aboriginal Australia.
Well, I guess that's a credit to you as well, that what you've absorbed, the Aboriginal people have sort of have said this is authentic. It's not, it's not a white person trying to imitate us sort of thing.
Well, you got to get through the gate, and there's plenty of testing time, Nigel.
Mm.
What would you white fella know about,
yes,
about our struggle? So you've got to take the testing time, I call it. You've got to pass through the gate, and you've got to be seen to be not just a...
Someone latching onto a bandwagon, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, not that anyone cared much about Indigenous issues at that time. So, but for whatever reason, it got under the wire and through the gate, that song, and it embedded itself in Australian folklore and in the Australian psyche, and is still there in many ways. So it's, I don't know, some songs come from you and some come through you. And I think that was definitely a song that came through me.
Mm-hmm. Goanna ran its course, and I noticed afterwards you relocated to the Gulf of Carpentaria. Was this, what drove you to do this? Were you looking for a deeper understanding of Indigenous culture, or what sort of drove you to move? Well, let's face it, it's quite a remote part of Australia, really.
It is. It was a lot of factors. I mean, at the time, what happened by end of 85, Oceania was a big commitment, the second album. We parted with our record company and we funded the album ourselves. It was a very ambitious project. It's a long story. There's some corporate shenanigans involved as well, but we were a long way into debt, and then we couldn't dig our way out of that. And so Goanna found itself in a position where we just couldn't trade our way out of that debt, and we disbanded at the end of 85. We did a few shows, maybe 86, 87, and then we realised we couldn't get to the third album and we had to call it quits. So it was a very hard time. It was a hard time where, I mean, the Gulf of Carpentaria was about as far away from the music industry as you could get.
Should imagine it was.
I was completely and utterly disenchanted by the music industry by that point, which was an industry. It was a capitalist construct, really, and it was about money and not about music. So I just wanted to get back to being an artist, I guess. And I had no, I was so financially disempowered, I had to really start again right from square one. And then by 88, I released that first solo album, Back to the Track. But it came from journeying. I went deeper into Aboriginal Australia too, I guess, into that Gulf country, North Queensland, and then across to Broome and spent time there. Got to know Jimmy Chai and the Pegrams really well. And that all kept feeding into my perception of what Australia really was, those experiences broadened.
I noticed that apart from Indigenous music, you've obviously got elsewhere you talk about your roots in Irish music, and your family, you're obviously descendant from Irish stock, I'd imagine. And I noticed also, I imagine you also recorded some Bob Dylan songs. And I'm just wondering, you toured Australia with Bob Dylan. Did you ever get to know him, or was he quite aloof?
I did a few shows with Dylan. Quite aloof, but there was the opportunity to meet. But what would I say? I mean, I know now what I would say. I know what question to ask about what songs. But at the time, what can you say? Love your music, Not really, but it was a funny moment when we played the Palais in St Kilda in Melbourne. And,
yes.
Mum and Dad, my mother and father were in Melbourne, and they couldn't get to see the show because it was sold out. So I was able to get them backstage passes. So she came backstage, and they were standing side of stage when I performed. And, of course, we were doing Solid Rock, and Tony Lovett, I think it was playing Didgeridoo. And next thing, Mum and Dad tell this amusing story about how this fella came running down the hall and onto the backstage area and stood beside them. And it was Bob, of course. And Mum said, he's very short. It's just a lovely moment where he would have looked at them, he would have worked it out who they would have been. And it was a lovely moment. But Dylan was such a huge influence on me from childhood. We had an English couple who lived next door to us in our little factory cottage that we grew up in. And Dad worked in the Nestlé factory for his whole life. And they moved next door and he was an engineer. They'd lived in a houseboat on the Thames in London. And one day when my brother was home from uni, he said, "Oh, come in. My friends have sent me some records from England." And this is in the 60s. And one of them was The Times They Are Changing. And we'd heard Peter, Paul and Mary and their very sanitized versions, beautiful, but sanitized versions of Blowing in the Wind and stuff. And then when I heard Dylan sing, and that album is monstrous, really. It's incredible.
Yes.
The Times They Are Changing, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, With God on Our Side. You know, he's changing timing. He sounds like an old man inhabiting a young man's body. Who was it said? You know, though, some of those Dylan songs feel like they existed forever and he was just channeling something very old. So that impacted on me powerfully. I would have only been about 10 years old.
Gee.
So I learned, one of the first things I got to do in public was sing at my school, to sing Blowing in the Wind at my little primary school. they're lovely little mythological tales of how these influences find their way to a little village of 300 people in southwest Victoria. Yeah.
Yes, all because your next door neighbour brought these Dylan records.
Absolutely, across. Yeah. That were sent to him from England. Yeah. Amazing.
I was surprised you were allowed to sing things like The Times Were Changing, because they were taken as very protest songs, and a lot of schools didn't like that sort of stuff.
Yeah, although I think it was Blowing in the Wind, so that was kind of. That was maybe a bit more generic,
bit more rural.
Or something, yeah. I don't know. And it was probably cute back in those days.
Yeah,
tenure,
probably.
That, yeah.
Yes. I'm talking to Shane Howard, who's a Dylan fan, but he's also an Australian legend as far as folk music and music in general is concerned. So I'm going to ask you, I noticed you toured Australia and then toured Ireland with Ireland's legendary singer, Mary Black. And I imagine that sort of tugged at your Irish roots, particularly singing in Ireland. And that would have exposed you to a new audience. How did Irish audiences relate to you?
I got to England, London, because we got to meet Richard Branson in Australia. And then I contacted him in 1983 when I was traveling around the world. I was going from recording in LA and then in New York with Warners and then going to London. And we started to have discussions with Virgin. But while we were there, I thought I might never get back here again. So we turned left, Ian Morrison and I, who was from Ireland originally, we turned left and we went to Ireland, did a whirlwind trip for a few days in a little bomb hire car. That was a great introduction to the country in a very short space of time, not really knowing where you were. And now I didn't get back there till 1993 with Mary. I met up with the Hot Ass Flowers when they came to Australia in 1990 or 91.
Oh, yeah.
And they were on the back of, I Can See Clearly Now, so they were flying high. And we toured together and did some shows. We did a recording together as well at that time. So Liam and Fegner, they're great friends, and we built a great friendship really over the years. You know, that was my kind of introduction in many ways to Irish music. I'd long had an interest in Irish trad music. We'd grown up on the Clancy Brothers as well as Bob Dylan and all that stuff. But then Mary did a tour in 92 and I was asked if I'd like to open for her. So I did that tour and we got on with her and her band. We got on like a house on fire. Declan Sinnott was playing guitar with her. He'd been in Moving Hearts, Irish band, great Irish band. They'd worked with Van Morrison.
Goodness.
Dave Early was playing drums with Mary at the time, and he played with us. He was our drummer as well, and he'd come from Van Morrison and Sade and all that stuff. So lovely, lovely fella, tragically killed in the 90s in a car accident. But so just got on really well with that mob. We had the best time touring Australia with Mary. And then 93, I got a phone call from Joe O'Reilly, her manager, and he said, "Shane, want you to come over to Ireland. Mary's had a big hit over here with his song Flesh and Blood.
Oh.
And I was absolutely stunned because they must have recorded the live show because I hadn't actually released it at that point. I thought someone was pulling my leg, but all of a sudden, you know, Flesh and Blood is top five in Ireland, and I flew to Ireland and took a little band with me, and we used Dave Early, Mary's drummer, as well. And the first five nights were in Dublin, sold out, and here is 5,000 people a night singing Flesh and Blood.
Oh, wow.
At full voice, and I'm on stage with Mary. It was very overwhelming. I thought, gee, if my dear old great-grandparents who came here to this area in southwest Victoria from Ngortamore, you know, from the Great Hunger in the 1840s, if they could see us now. And I did actually get to make connection back to family who are still there. It was a very powerful thing to join.
Wow, a full circle.
Yeah.
Generations down the track.
And what a way to do it, hey, Nigel?
Yes. And, you know, Mary Black and her whole, the Black family, they are Irish music in so many ways, aren't they?
She's such a queen, one of the queens of Irish music, really. And great soul. We got on like a house on fire. It was just the most joyful way to see every little nook and cranny of Ireland, tour around, you know, and play the Cork Opera House and all those, the Belfast, the Ulster Hall, and the troubles were still happening at that time. So it was very sobering. It was an initiation, really, into Irish life. And it's funny, Nigel, but back here in Australia before that happened, I'm out in the desert with an old Indigenous man, Aboriginal man from that country, desert. And he said to me, where are you from? And I said, I'm from southwest Victoria, you know, down in Gunditjmara country. And he said, yeah, but where are you really from? Where are your people from? And I said, well, ostensibly from Ireland. And he said, you know, what's your song? What are the songs? What's your language? What's the dance? And here I was feeling sorry for Aboriginal people who had lost their language and culture and, you know, their traditions. And I suddenly had to go, I lost mine.
Yes.
And that began for me. And then Mary inviting me to Ireland began a long relationship that's gone on, you know, for a dozen journeys or more since. And she's recorded 9 of my songs. Her most recent song, which is basically her swan song, is one of mine, a song called Light of Day. So
what a fantastic it's an achievement for you, but it's just, it's more than an achievement. It's just an association that she's recorded so many of your songs and as her, almost her swan song. Has she retired or she's just about to? One or the other, isn't it?
That's right. She's about to do the final tour.
Yeah.
So really lovely to know.
Well, she must.
So many of my songs have made it into the kind of canon of Irish song. It's very, very great. And ironic too that the person that should lay down that quest to me was an Aboriginal man in the desert, So, in a funny way, Solid Rock set me up to go and find my own cultural heritage.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a question of joining the dots, isn't it? It's amazing.
It is, and of course, it's a musical journey as well. It's a journey by song too, Nigel. So much of the journey is about where the songs will lead you.
I'm going to take you there in a minute, but just before we go there was a gap of 40-odd years, and then you revisited Goanna with a wonderful album called Spirit Returns. That we're talking about 2022, aren't we? So not that long ago, really.
No, Spirit Returns was actually in 1998.
Oh, okay.
It's been an anomaly. Goanna has never officially finished.
just goes round and round.
It's still on the cards, but we did do 2022. We did that huge tour around Australia, which was amazing. But we did come together again in 1998 for the Melbourne International Buds Festival. And we only did those two shows at the Melbourne Concert Hall. And they were filmed and recorded. It's never seen the light of day, but there was the Pegram Brothers, Seamus Begley from Ireland, Liam O'Mainley from Hot House Flowers, a 15-year-old William Barton, who has since gone on to become the absolute master of the didgeridoo, Yeraki. Judith Durham joined us and sang Murray Time. This is all was all filmed. We're working on releasing that later this year. There's lots of lovely treasures still hidden away from that period. But that was a precious time. And then 2022 to regather, you know, and go and do a lap of honour, really, and say goodbye to everyone was really beautiful.
So, Shane, your back catalogue is inspirational, and it's a testimony to the dedication of your craft over, and it is a craft over so many years now. And I'm really excited to hear that you're joining this new show for the sake of a song, which is coming to Victoria very soon, folks, in May. So you're appearing with Shane Nicholson and Sarah Stora, two great favourites there. So what does that tour mean to you for the sake of a song?
For the sake of a song is the name of an old Towns Van Zandt song. Beautiful songwriter, Texan songwriter, long gone now, but masterful storyteller and songwriter. And you said about a craft, it is a craft, it is an art, and it is a vocation, I think. You know, like, I can't turn it off. The songs keep coming, even at this late stage of my life. And they ask to be written. And so I'm obedient to, I don't know what it is, the muse, their demands, whatever they are. And in many ways, your songs go on to map your life. And Towns Van Zandt gave us so many beautiful songs, amazing songs. And what I love, Shane Nicholson, it was his idea, this for the sake of the song, and the three of us getting together. And I've known Sarah. In the past, we've written a song together. We've done some stuff together. Her beautiful voice, sublime, yes. Beautiful. And she is a really gifted songwriter as well. She's a country girl, you know, grew up on the farm up north of Victoria. She has that earthiness about her writing, but she's got, it is a gift. They say in Ireland, a poet is born and not made, and there's something in that. I don't know whether it's something you can study. You can, but I think there's...
Something has got to come from the heart and the soul, perhaps.
It comes from somewhere else. I don't know. Maybe it's ancestral lines. Maybe it's genetic. I don't know. But it comes down the ages. And Sarah has this beautiful turn of phrase. She has this lovely way of... You know when a song or a lyric just catches you off guard? And
yes.
You go, oh, wow, it's a moment where you go... Dylan does it all the time. You know, I'm trying to love my brother, but mother, things aren't going well. You know, like, it's not dark yet, but it's getting there. And Sarah has... Shane Nicholson has this lovely line in one of his songs about, left my love caught on a rusty nail. Just lovely turns of phrase that have never been thought of before or used before. They're just, and they expand their imagination. Leonard Cohen talks about songwriting and about poetry, about how we all have our own magical system for writing and creating songs. And it's really interesting to work with other songwriters and to see what magical systems they employ. And I think the inevitable intention is to create the work so that you build the scaffolding and you make the song and you take the scaffolding down, but no one can see where the scaffolding has been.
That's a great thought, actually. You know, I was speaking to Sarah the other week, and she is, I think it's very genuine, she's very daunted to be working with the two Shanes. She almost said that she didn't think she had a place in there, you know.
That's her humility and her modesty. She is a giant in her own quiet way, and she's a lovely self-deprecating nature, which is disarming, actually. And I know why people love her and love her work so much, because one, her voice is just beautiful, But her stories are about commonplace things, but she elevates those things to art, in a really beautiful way. And then that great song about Dan, you know, dandelions blowing in the wind, you know, da da da. You know, sometimes I get so down, sometimes I'm so high above the ground. Just this lovely way of going from the commonplace to the really deep emotion.
Well, I think that essence is in the three of you, really. You, in your own ways, you're all, of course, have different influences and all the rest of it. But
yeah,
that same sort of, there's a common ground there, if I may use that expression. And I think when I heard this, for the sake of a song coming up, I thought this is absolutely fantastic. I mean, there's three different artists who've got a long lifespan in the entertainment industry, not in the entertainment industry, but more in crafting songs. Probably a better way of putting it.
We make songs, that's what we do, and it is an act of making, it is a working thing, it's a doing thing. It doesn't fall in your lap, like you have to, what did Yeats call it? The hammering into unity. Yeah, I call it. It's, you know, there's a bit of panel beating and spot welding to get them into shape. Sometimes they just won't go, and you kind of sometimes you just got to abandon it and go. It may find its way later, and they often do.
Yes,
yeah, sometimes. Yeah,
they come back.
Well, sometimes they're awaiting an experience you haven't had,
and then all of a sudden you can join the dots together, to use that expression again.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Shane, I think it's fabulous. I'm going to give people the dates after I go out and play the last song we're going to do very soon, which is going to be Solid Rock, for anyone who possibly has forgotten it, by the way. So I have enjoyed listening to your music over the years, and I've certainly enjoyed speaking with you today. And I'm also looking forward to seeing you in concert with Shane Nicholson and Sarah Storer in May when you come to Victoria. Well, you're in Victoria now. I want to thank you for your time today. And we'll go out with the never-to-be-forgotten Solid Rock. So stay with us, folks. And after the Solid Rock, I'm going to get a pen and paper, folks, because I'm going to tell you where these concerts are, because you need to go along in May and catch these three artists. And they are artists in song. And telling you about how they've come to write these songs that you know so well. And so let's do Solid Rock with Goanna. And we'll go out with that one. Thanks, Shane. Thank you very much.
Bye now.